So Matthew chapter 11, verses 20 to 24. Then Jesus began to denounce the towns in which most of his miracles had been performed, because they did not repent. Woe to you, Chorazin! Woe to you, Bethsaida! For if the miracles that were performed in you had been performed in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago in sackcloths and ashes. But I tell you, it will be more miserable for Tyre and Sidon on the day of judgment than for you. And you, Capernaum, will you be lifted to the heavens? No, you will go down to Hades. For if the miracles that were performed in you had been performed in Sodom, it would have remained to this day. But I tell you that it will be more bearable for Sodom on the day of judgment than for you. And we trust that God will add his blessing to the reading of his word.
We've just sung those words that our speech and our thinking would find favour in your sight, our rock and redeemer. And we can do this because you've revealed yourself to us. You've revealed yourself in what you have made, and ultimately, or more clearly should I say, in the words of the Bible, and ultimately in your Son, Jesus Christ. So please make us wise to answer questions thoughtfully and wisely. Amen. Well, as you know, we've been each month for a little while, we've taken a break from whatever book in the Bible we've been looking at and asking typically tough questions that we might get asked, or you might think for yourself these things. And it's to help us. Either we're someone who's asking them, or we know someone who is. And very often, the question does come, what about those who've never heard the gospel? How can they become a Christian if they've never heard anything? What does God do with those people? And normally that is asked by a Christian, or someone who's thinking very seriously about becoming one, rather than someone who's completely way out there. If someone's never heard very much themselves and you started to talk to them, they're probably unlikely to ask that question, but you never know. So it is a good question to think about in and of itself, but also it's a good question to think about because it models how to answer a question, I think. Have you ever found that someone asks you a question and you get completely stumped? If you do, you're in very good company. And then afterwards, you think about what to say. And have you noticed that when that happens, you never lose an argument on the replay? You know, when you've got stumped, and you think about it afterwards, you always have the right answer, don't you? And so the person walks away and you want to just go, come back, ask again, but it's gone. They've walked away by then. We want to be much quicker, like some people we've heard of. You may have heard of Sir Robert Menzies. He was an ex-Australian Prime Minister. In fact, he's more famous for his wit than being a Prime Minister. One time he was taunted in Parliament when he got up to speak, and just like our Parliament, they taunt each other, and someone shouted out, you know, that very Australian, isn't it? Tell us everything you know, Rob. It won't take long. And he replied, I'll tell you everything we both know. It won't take any longer. And someone else taunted at him, I wouldn't vote for you if you were the Archangel Gabriel. And he, without even thinking about it, answered, if I were, you wouldn't be in my constituency. And of course, Winston Churchill was good at this as well. His famous one, which you've probably heard before, is when a woman said to him, sir, you are drunk. And he replied, madam, I may be drunk, but you are ugly. And in the morning, I will be sober. And Oscar Wilde, Groucho Marx, they're all brilliant at this. And most of us are not like that. And can I suggest that's good? Because sometimes it is just as well that we aren't that quick. God made you the way you are. He knew what he was doing when he made you a bit slower than Robert Menzies or Winston Churchill. Because sometimes the quickest response isn't always the most helpful one, particularly if you make someone feel small. So it's okay. God uses our weaknesses and our slowness sometimes. But also, this, like I said, this is a good question for modelling questions because it isn't really about answering the question. Now, that sounds dishonest, doesn't it? It isn't really about answering the question. It's not dishonest to go a bit further. Let me explain why. This is a question that's a good test case for these principles that I've just put up. Some basic principles for answering questions about God and the Bible and things like that. The first one is be truthful. Don't make up stuff or use unfair tactics. Now, other people do use unfair tactics. If you ever watch Question Time or any, right across the political spectrum, they all do this. The people use unfair tactics. Things aren't completely true, or using truth loosely, using statistics incorrectly and stuff like that. I did an engineering degree, so when people use statistics incorrectly, I get very cross. It's not a matter of truth, it's a matter of just using the maths wrong that makes me cross. People use tricks, they use flippy-floppy logic, that they use logic one way to make one point and the opposite to make another. They misrepresent things, they withhold truth, and we don't need to do that, even if it might seem advantageous for us to do that. The second thing is to be loving. Don't be smug. It's hard to change your mind. It's hard to change your mind when you very obviously lost somewhere, isn't it? It's very hard to change your mind about things. Don't gloat. If you can, try to make the point whilst losing. But let people keep face at all costs. Third thing is be honest. If you can't answer, say so. So I can try and find out. I'll ask some people at church. Someone's bound to have asked that question before. But personally, I don't know. You've got me stumped. And the fourth thing, this is very important, be evangelistic. Don't answer a question for the sake of answering the question. Try and bring people to the gospel and to Jesus. Avoid side roads and red herrings. And fifthly, be prayerful. God changes people, not you. So even if you're really, you know, in the middle of something and someone says, you're a Christian, what do you think about? Just, you know, quickly to God, just help, and then try and answer the question. And answer the question behind the question. You've heard me say that one before. Why are they asking that question? Or if you're asking, why are you asking that question? You won't always know, but it's worth trying and thinking about it and asking backup and follow-up questions. And if you're genuinely asking this question, what is your question really about? And we were thinking about something to do with this sort of thing on Thursday evening, and Fran made the comment when I said, share the gospel with 5 minutes, and he said, no one's ever given me 5 minutes before. Well, I'm taking however long I'm going to take. I'm going to be speaking for ages. And you're never going to get this long to answer someone's question, are you? So I'm just giving you some ideas and some principles that will be in the back of your mind in a conversation. So if someone said to you, what happens to those who've never heard the gospel? You're unlikely to say, sit down for half an hour. I've got a few things to say. But there's a few things here that might help you. And of course, the best person with these five principles and answering the question behind the question is Jesus. He's brilliant at it, as you might expect. Jesus sometimes subverts the questions. He sort of says, slightly paraphrasing here, he sort of says, what you should have been asking is this, or what you're really asking is this. And he sticks to those five principles there, and even the one about bringing everything to being about him. And so Jesus asks questions back. And he says, this is really a question about something else. You should really have asked this question. And you ask this because whatever. Now, we can't do some of the things that Jesus did. We can't see into people's hearts as he did. But he does teach us something about what about these important issues and how we get down to business. So this question about what about those who've never heard, like I said, often asked by people a bit more on the inside, what are they really asking? Well, there's a few things that they might be asking, two distinct possibilities. The first one is God fair? And of course, if he isn't fair, is he really God? Secondly, and more likely perhaps, it's some variation of a red herring, but worth answering because it could be used as a delay. So I'm not going to make up my mind about this because there's this thing still hanging out there. Or an excuse not to speak to others. I might be better off leaving them never hearing about the gospel. But the point is, and this is quite an important part of the answer, in fact you could start with this as a one-liner to see where it gets you, is, well, you have heard, what are you going to do about it? Never mind about those who have never heard, you have heard. What now? Deuteronomy 29:29, you often hear me bring up in these tough questions, basically Deuteronomy 29:29, God hasn't told us everything. It says the secret things belong to the Lord. Secret things belong to him. We won't know everything. But the things revealed belong to us and our children forever, so that we may follow all the words of this law. Now, this is a classic one in some respects, because we're not directly told about those who've not heard. Why? Because it says the Bible is practical. It's not given for us to have interesting answers to interesting questions and satisfy our curiosity, but rather Deuteronomy 29:29, so we can live for God. So in the Bible, we're invited to respond to God's offer and to spread that offer. So you have heard, go and do something with it. It doesn't directly say about those who've never heard. But we've got some important bits of information for that answer. The first thing is, we can trust God. He is just. His judgments are always fair. The Bible is God preaching God. That's a helpful phrase Jim Packer used. The Bible is God preaching God. It says much about his character, and the core of his character is that he is just and fair. He will judge people by their deeds and by their response to him. He makes an offer of forgiveness. How will they respond to him? I always have said at funerals of non-Christians something along those lines, which of course, when you scratch away, really means I don't know where this person's at, but God will be fair to them. And sadly, for most funerals, God will be fair to them in hell. But even then, I can't say whether that person is or not, because you never know 100% those person's last moments, what they were thinking, had they responded to God. We know, don't we, why the question is asked, because it's very clear in the Bible that only those people will only be saved on the basis of their faith in Jesus' death. So no one in heaven is going to be saying, praise Buddha, praise Allah, I'm here. We've all sinned against God, and so God would be 100% fair to save no one. All have fallen short. No one seeks God, as we're reminded in Romans 3, as just a blunt truth. So now we can narrow the question down. The question is God fair to save some and not others? And Romans 9 reframes that question, well, who are you to ask the question in the first place? God is within his right to save no one at all. So is he unfair, being partial in saving just some and not putting out the escape route to some? But however we answer, every passage of the Bible affirms that God is totally fair and just. Now, that doesn't mean then we can conclude that he saves those who've not heard, at least not necessarily. But if those who've not heard are not saved, it is fair, and perhaps we need to rethink our understanding of fair. The problem might be with us, not with God. The second thing is to think about the question again. So God is fair. The second thing is there anyone who hasn't heard? You might think, well, of course there is. Bear with me a minute. It's true, there are some people who've never heard the gospel. But this is a small group that's getting smaller. Often you hear people talk about the ignorance there is about God. That is true. It's even true within the church. But I have been surprised sometimes when we've done evangelism, some of us chatting to people in the streets and stuff, sometimes it's quite surprising what people do know. The gospel's growing throughout Asia. Africa is substantially Christian. I mean, I know there's all sorts of issues, stuff in the news the other day about people mixing Christianity with paganism, but even so, there are a lot of Christians in Africa. And Christianity is growing all over the place. Where isn't the gospel? Well, the area in most need is what's often called the 1040 window. That's 10 degrees to 40 degrees latitude. But there's still some church there. Even there, can we say people have never heard? There's radio, satellite, TV, internet evangelism getting the message out, as well as an underground church movement. But even so, there are people who've never heard. There are lost tribes and so on. People in the past who've not heard. Or have they? Just look over the psalm we've just sung, Psalm 19. And Romans 1 picks up some of those ideas from Psalm 19. And both tell us that actually everyone has heard about God. They've heard about God through creation. So that psalm we just sang talks about all heaven declaring God's glory, and then starts poetically talking about in the heavens. Romans 1 verse 20 says, "For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse." Men are without excuse. So in creation, we can all see God, the glory of God. Now, true, it doesn't tell us the way to salvation, but nobody, according to Romans 1, nobody ever sees creation and thinks, "Oh no, I'd better get myself right with God then." Romans 1:21 onwards tells us rather we see the truth about God in creation, and we take that truth and we suppress it. We push it down. We make up images of God, things that he made, and we make up our own truth about it. And that's been everyone's response, to go against the evidence, which makes us self-condemned. Now, I'll try to illustrate this. Illustrations never perfectly get to the point, do they? But I've tried to make an illustration for this. If the truth of our condition before God is the equivalent of being in a building that's caught fire, and the gospel is an escape route with a big neon sign on it, people who hear the gospel have a choice. They can face the fire or walk out the escape route. And inexplicably to us, we're not dealing with predestination and will, bondage of the will and that sort of thing. Deal with that, another tough question. But for now, just imagine you're in the fire. And inexplicably to us, some people choose to face the fire, despite the clear signpost. They don't believe it, or it's too good to be true. Whatever it is, they don't trust it. So following the illustration a bit further, what about those who either have no escape route or at least don't have the big signpost to it? God hasn't been fair to them. But the way it's put in Romans 1, and to keep pushing my illustration to breaking point, what people have done in that situation is they've sat in the fire, not looking for the escape route, they're looking for petrol. In fact, they're looking for petrol while enjoying warming themselves against the flames that are eventually going to consume them. They're certainly not looking for an escape route. That's the picture of Romans 1. In fact, when we do get the exit with a neon sign, we still avoid it, carry on looking for petrol until God changes our mind. The evidence of God, his power and goodness, is all around us, and also the knowledge of God is in our conscience. And really, this is the only basis for speaking of God to a complete atheist. But with all that knowledge, we suppress, or as Paul puts it in Romans 1, exchange the truth. Our actions are against our knowledge, and if we are religiously inclined, we just make up a pretend God in our image. Our image, or things that God has made, to avoid his authority over us. And even if we're not religiously inclined, we still worship. We worship things. Nature, things that we've made, you know, you name it, we'll worship it. Anything but God himself. And when we're offered the escape, we don't really warm to it. So everyone has heard something. Psalm 19 makes it clear that to know God, we just need to look around us. But to be saved, we need his law, as Psalm 19 puts it. We need special knowledge of God himself, which is given to us in the Bible. But what Romans 1 and Psalm 19 show us is that we know enough to be accountable. Now put those two things together, that God's fair and that we've heard something. God is fair and we've exchanged the truth for a lie. Everyone knows something from creation. So someone in Turkey looking at the stars who knows very little, and a child in Chelmsford probably knows a bit more, someone who's been to Sunday school a bit more still. And you know a lot more. We all know something, but different amounts. So that, and God is always fair and just, and you get Jesus' words that Tim read to us earlier in Matthew 11, verses 20 to 24. And it might be worth turning back to for a few moments. The point Jesus makes is that you are judged by what you know. That's our third point. The more you know, the more accountable you are. So you are accountable from what you know in creation, but you know a lot more once someone's spoken the gospel to you. And the comparison here is between Sodom and Gomorrah on the one side and the places where Jesus preached on the other. The places that heard Jesus' sermons and saw his miracles, Jesus says, are guilty of something far greater than Sodom and Gomorrah, although they were more morally upright. They knew more, they had more evidence, and yet they still rejected. Therefore, they will be judged more severely. Those amazing words of Jesus in chapter 11, verse 24, "But I tell you, it will be more bearable for Sodom on the day of judgment than for you." Sodom and Gomorrah will be better off than those cities who had seen and heard Jesus firsthand. Now notice what Jesus doesn't say. Sodom and Gomorrah, well, it wasn't really their fault, so we'll let them off. They didn't know anything. But what he is saying is they knew less. They were judged in Genesis, and what's clear from 1 and 2 Peter is that the citizens of Sodom and Gomorrah were sent to hell for their behaviour, and God was right to do that. He was justified because of their wickedness. Their punishment for them is right, but their punishment will not be as severe as those who saw Jesus' miracles, who heard his sermons, and still rejected. So the people in Sodom and Gomorrah were in the wrong, for sure. They were still accountable for their actions because of Psalm 19 and Romans 1. They knew enough from creation to know what they were doing was wrong. And Sodom may have known a little bit more because some people would have had chats with Lot. But God will deal more sternly with these cities like Chorazin and Bethsaida because of their great privilege that they ignored. They saw Jesus and they did nothing. And of course, we're much nearer the second than the first. We've heard Jesus' warnings, we've heard the gospel. This makes the question much more personal and pointed, doesn't it? If someone asks you this, or if you're asking this, to turn it round on them in a very pointed way. When someone asks you the question, you can say, well, look at what Jesus says about it. What will you do as you've heard? Particularly people who've had lots of Christian involvement. Now, I think I've probably said enough to draw some threads together and to answer to both a non-Christian and a Christian. To the non-Christian, you can say, but you have heard something about it. Leave the others to God. He will be fair with them. But you have heard something. Particularly those who've come from Christian families, so who've been baptized, been a part of a church, had all those privileges. The Bible isn't written to satisfy your curiosity. You've heard, you know enough. What will you do now? Suddenly the question is lifted from this philosophical out there. Oh, I wonder what happens to people, you know, like when a tree falls down in the woods and no one's there, does it make any noise? Those sort of silly questions. To something intensely personal and something from out there to very in here. What will you do because you do know? Maybe polite to go a bit further, and certainly for Christians, a few lot here, is to say, you have heard, do something. Make sure others have heard too. We certainly know that no one's saved apart from Christ, and we're accountable from knowledge from creation. So although it's not spelt out in so many words, it would strongly suggest that the lost are just that, lost. Without knowing Christ, they're in a dire situation. So we need to find them and tell them. And that's been the motivation for missionaries for 2,000 millennia. That's hymn we sang earlier, that second hymn, was written for the mission organisation OMF. It's what's always inspired them to do this. And that's why the message is still urgent. It's, as Paul puts it in Romans, how beautiful are the feet that bring good news. To think there are Christians who, there's an idea that people are out there, people who are Christians, who don't know they're Christians. You know, so they're honest seekers, they just haven't heard the gospel there. C.S. Lewis comes up with this idea in The Last Battle. The previous Archbishop of Canterbury had a similar idea, the anonymous Christian. It seems to me at best to be highly speculative, at best. So I think we can just say we need to go and reach people. People who have not heard, they need to hear. I think to say that people are sincere from other religions, I just don't think We can say that. The Bible doesn't push us that way, does it? So we should support people who go out to unreached places around the world, to Islamic countries, to communist countries, but also in England there's such groups. And also your average English person thinks they know a lot more than they do, and they certainly need to hear. And sometimes these people are not going to fall into our laps. So Christians have a high motivation to reach the so far unreached, those who are ignorant and near us, and to urge those who know not to put it off any longer. They are accountable if they shun what they know, especially so for those who've been brought up in a Christian home, especially those who've in some way experienced some blessing from the church, even really just living in a Christian or post-Christian culture. It's extremely serious to face death without having responded to God's call, but far more so the more the warnings and the privileges we've experienced to ignore those. So it's a great question to be asked, to spur Christians on and to give non-Christians a sense of urgency and to make things a little bit more personal. I'm going to pray, and what I've said in previous weeks is the tough question is slightly set up because I think of the tough question, and I only think of the tough questions I can answer. I might have raised things that you want to ask questions about, and I can't, as I've said, I'll be honest with you, I can't always answer them. We'll try that in a moment. So let me pray, and then I'll let you ask any questions. I tell you that it will be more bearable for Sodom on the day of judgment than for you. Lord, we find these words very sobering, that we are accountable, that everyone is accountable because everyone knows something of you from their conscience and from creation, and yet we know that we are particularly accountable because you've revealed yourself to us in these words. And so we ask that we would take this very seriously, and it would be a motivation to us to let others who have yet to hear about you know. And please help us as well when people are struggling with a question of your fairness, to be able to give them an adequate answer. Amen.